Shrink Wrap Radio number 443, Reflections on the Mindfulness Boom, with Dr. Ron Purser.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
On today's show, I'll be speaking with Dr. Ron Purser, management professor at San Francisco State University, Zen teacher, and prolific author on mindfulness in organizations. For more information about Dr. Ron Purser, please see our show notes on shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Ron Purser, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you on the show. A friend sent me a link to the Salon.com article that you co-authored on mindfulness. Mindfulness's truthiness problem. And I noticed your name as one of the authors, and it rang a bell. I was pretty sure you'd been a student at Sonoma State University, where I taught for so many years. And I looked you up, and sure enough, it was true. Even though I don't think you ever took a class from me. I must have heard your name in the halls, or maybe one of my colleagues had been singing your praises. I don't know what it was.
Yeah, that's right. I was at Sonoma State as an undergraduate from 1981 to 1985, and really enjoyed that program. In fact, I basically ditched a experimental psychology program that I had been at Southern Illinois University when I sort of stumbled across some magazine that talked about humanistic psychology programs, and I believe Sonoma State and one in Georgia were the only two.
That's right.
And I said, well, I'm out of here. I'm transferred. So,
what was it about humanistic psychology that, you know, you were in an experimental psychology program already? What was it about humanistic psychology that spoke to you? Just that phrase. I mean, did you know anything about it at that time?
Yeah, I actually had been reading on my own Carl Rogers and Fritz Perls and Abraham Maslow and all the big guns. And
yeah,
all the courses I had been taking, you know, were basically rat experimental psychology. And I had at that time, a really great interest in dreams. And in fact, I remember seeing a flyer for Stanley Krippner giving a talk. He's the one who sort of tipped me off, I think, initially about Sonoma State. But I think it was because I had this interest in human experience and in subjective experience and consciousness. It was non-existent in the paradigm of psychology that I was immersed in at Southern Illinois University. So, yeah, I think that was really the main well, not to mention Northern California, to get into a nice
Yeah. And another connection that we discovered since we set up this interview and exchanged a couple of emails back and forth, it turns out that both you and I have been ham radio operators or amateur radio operators.
Yeah, that was an interesting coincidence too. Yeah,
it was. And I wasn't sure how you knew that, except that I had vanity license plates on my car with my call letters, AB6XR. And maybe you saw my car in the parking lot or something.
That could be. I may have read something, too.
Okay. It's a synchronicity. What can we say? And then, of course, I'm curious now with this interest in dreams and humanistic psychology and so on. How did you happen to go from psychology into teaching management? You're now a management professor at San Francisco State. Is that where you are now? Yeah.
Right. Well, it was in my senior year, actually, at Sonoma State, and I decided to take an elective in the business school from Saul Eisen.
Sure.
Teaching a course in organizational behavior. The first book that I think he assigned us was a book by Edgar Schein on process consultation. I just fell in love with a lot of the clinical ideas that were still psychological in terms of the consulting nature of process consultation. And the field of organizational behavior is so interdisciplinary.
Yes, yes.
I had been working part-time at a psychiatric hospital as well, and I started having second thoughts whether I really wanted to go in that direction to become a clinical psychologist. So working in the field with organizations, it seemed like maybe I could have a larger impact on people, because people spend, 8 to 10, 12 hours a day at work. So I thought, well, maybe that's really where these interventions need to occur.
Mm-hmm.
And that fascinated me at the time. So it was through that sort of serendipity to take a course like that, it really shifted my whole direction.
Yeah, and there is a large overlap between psychology and organization development and all of its related areas. So that makes total sense to me. Well, we're going to talk about mindfulness during this interview. And you mentioned to me in one of our subsequent communications via email that your article had gone viral, as did a subsequent one that you wrote on the Huffington Post titled Beyond Mech Mindfulness, which is a great title, by the way. When you say it went viral, what are we talking about?
Well, the Beyond McMindfulness article in the Huffington Post, when I say it went viral, it means it just became circulated through the blogosphere in many different outlets. But, you know how Facebook is. You can look to see how many people clicked like on it.
Yeah.
Like 10,000 likes and like 2,000 shares. It really got circulated in different spheres, like the Buddhist communities started to comment on it. The mindfulness clinical community started to comment on it. There were many other articles that kind of were generated as a result of that. So I think it really started to shift the discourse towards asking deeper questions about the movement, if you want to call it that, the mindfulness movement.
Yes.
Especially in terms of perhaps its ethical dimensions. That was a key element of that critique of that article.
Yeah, and we're going to get into that. Yeah, well, when I mentioned that it had, or you had mentioned that it went viral, I kind of resonated to that idea because as I was looking at one of them, there was a whole comment section under the article, which was as interesting as the article was, with people going pro and con and every which way. And it really, as you say, it sparked a lot of thought and a lot of discussion. What do you think was the nerve these two articles struck among readers that made them so widely read?
That's a good question. I think maybe one aspect is that probably it struck a nerve among some people that perhaps had a sense that the commodification of mindfulness was really, really taking off in terms of becoming almost a faddishness of it. And I think that really probably struck a nerve.
Yeah, and that's what really caught my attention. I can tell you that what grabbed me was that I've been doing lots of interviews on mindfulness, and I've said something here, somewhat jokingly, that I think we might be in the midst of a mindfulness bubble. Not that I'm skeptical of the benefits, but I think overexposure in the media might trivialize it. I don't think it's possible to write a book about therapy today or neuroscience without at least a nod to mindfulness. It's become de rigueur, I think. And your article struck me as resonant with that idea.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm with you on that. And I try to make it clear as well that I don't think anyone is trying to dispute the benefits that people may receive from practicing mindfulness. I think it's often misinterpreted when someone starts to ask questions about the ethical aspects that may be overlooked or sort of the overselling of this. I mean, if you think about it, I actually saw a figure that the mindfulness has become a $4 billion industry believe it or
not. Oh, my goodness.
I mean, well, yoga was estimated at being a $27 billion industry.
Incredible.
So there is a lot of money being made on this trend. I think there was even a market research firm last year that actually pinpointed that mindfulness was one of the hottest marketing trends to capitalize on. So, yeah, I mean, there is that aspect of it. I think other people, perhaps more people that have been practicing meditation for a long time, and I'm probably referring here mostly to Western Buddhists, they're sort of sitting back and looking at this from a kind of a different perspective. They're saying, well, it's very interesting how, you know, we've been practicing meditation, different forms of it. And in a way, there's a very interesting book, if you don't mind me mentioning, by Jeff Wilson, a colleague of mine, called Mindful America.
Uh-huh.
And he does a great job of actually, almost as a sociologist, trying to understand how mindfulness has come into a capitalist society, a market-based society, and just, you know, what that does to some phenomena like that. It's it has to be mainstreamed. It has to be marketed. It's interesting. It's an interesting phenomenon.
Yeah. Well, tell us about the word truthiness in the title of that first article.
Okay.
What are you getting at there when you use the word truthiness?
Yeah. Well, I have to give credit to my co-author on that one, Andy Cooper. What we were trying to get at in that particular article in Salon was sort of the overhyping, not only of mindfulness itself, but the science as it's been either reported by scientists themselves, but probably more so by the media, in terms of the claims that have been made about how mindfulness can basically be good for just about everything. And so the truthiness problem that we're referring to is that a lot of the science is not as rigorous and as replicable as it's made out to be.
Uh-huh.
So it's almost like science becomes a branding mechanism for marketing.
Yes.
Mindfulness.
Yes.
You know, all the science has said that mindfulness works and it's good for you. And it's just cherry picking of a few studies, and then they hype it up into making it sound like it's, you know, completely been validated. And, you know, even a lot of my friends and colleagues are scientists doing research on mindfulness. And they're very, very aware of this, very, very circumspect about it. In fact, they've been talking among themselves about how this overhyping is causing a backlash, or could cause a backlash.
Yeah, and that was my thought as well. Now, maybe we should take a step back and have you give us a sense of your Buddhist credentials, if you will.
My Buddhist credentials?
Yeah. Well, for one thing, I noticed in your email signature that you are a teacher of a Korean form of Buddhism, and I wasn't even aware that there was a Korean form. We've all become so aware of the Tibetan influence and the Japanese influence and so on.
Sure. Well, that goes way back. I mean, I was interested, you know, in Buddhism when I was like 18, 19, 20 years old. You know, I think a lot of us were just reading books like by Alan Watts and Philip Kaplow and some of those great books.
Yeah.
At the time, Three Pillars of Zen. And I was basic dabbling. And it wasn't until I moved out to California and discovered, actually, I did start in the Tibetan tradition. I stumbled across the Nyingma Institute, the Tibetan Nyingma Institute in Berkeley, and began taking courses and workshops there. And a very interesting Tibetan Lama by the name of Tarthang Tukku Rinpoche, which is kind of a formal honorific title for Tibetan Lamas, had started this institute and had been very prolific in writing many books for Westerners, sort of opening it up, the gates, you know, to the Dharma, to the West. And he was actually one of the first Tibetan Lamas to come to the United States. I think he came here in 1969, at the same time as Chögyam Trungpa did. So I became very immersed in that community. I am still connected to that community, very, very influenced by his teachings, both not just on the Buddhist side, but also a set of teachings that are kind of overlooked and not very well known, I don't really want to get deeply into that right now, but I will mention that it's a secular approach to inquiry, I guess is a word. It's called Time, Space, and Knowledge, A New Vision of Reality. And it's interesting because he said, you know, this is my gift to the West. It's not Buddhist. It's secular. Don't have to subscribe to any sort of Buddhist framework or belief system or anything like that. So that really intrigued me. And I'm still doing that sort of practice. And then gradually over time, through moving to graduate school, I began to practice Zen. There was a great Zen teacher in Cleveland. In fact, that was probably the only Buddhist center in Cleveland at the time. And then I stumbled across a Korean teacher, the Venerable Jongmae Kenneth Park, who is the overseas bishop for the Korean Taigo Zen Order. He established this order in Europe and in the United States about 30 years ago. He was actually a political asylum. He was given political asylum. He was tortured and thrown in prison in Korea, and Amnesty International got him out. So yeah, I've been in that tradition for about 2 or 3 years. And it is interesting. A lot of people don't know that when they hear the word Zen, that really is associated with Japanese Zen, but Korean Chan's a Chinese word for Zen, was actually transmitted from Korea to Japan. So basically, if you look at the transmission, it's from China to Korea and then over to Japan. So yeah, it's a long-established lineage and tradition.
Well, that's fascinating. So with that background under our belts, let's come back to your article. And in it, you refer to the mainstreaming of mindfulness. And that phrase that you used earlier really gets at it nicely. What do you see as the upside and the downside of the mainstreaming of mindfulness?
Well, okay. The mainstreaming of mindfulness has made this practice widely accessible to millions of people that would not have otherwise been attracted to it because of its formerly religious trappings within the Buddhist tradition. There are other traditions as well that have contemplative similarities to the Buddhist practice of mindfulness. But for the most part, the mainstreaming of mindfulness made it acceptable, made it less threatening to people who were not really looking for a religious way in terms of a spiritual path. It was initially offered as a clinical method for relieving stress and anxiety and chronic pain and many psychosomatic symptoms. So it became all medicalized, you could say, in terms of its initial establishment. And for that reason, I think that it has completely opened up the West to understanding that there are ways of relieving suffering that don't depend on psychoactive drugs or pharmaceuticals and so on. That's not to say that mindfulness should replace those in all cases, but it certainly has made it more accessible to a wider audience. So that's the upside. I'm not so sure I would say I see a downside per se, except I think that we are in the very early stages of seeing the introduction of mindfulness to the West. And because it started in a clinical context, in a therapeutic context, it's operating within certain paradigmatic assumptions about its potential. And right now, I think it's been used primarily on an individual level in terms of helping individuals cope and deal with the stresses of modern life. So it's not necessarily a downside that I see, but I see opportunities that may be missed or need to be thought about in terms of how we might think about stress and anxiety of modern life, not necessarily as exclusively a individual privatized psychological problem, but that the social world, our socioeconomic structures of society, actually could have an awful lot to do with the stresses and anxieties that we're experiencing. And so my critique, really, and my passion is how can we expand the mindfulness movement to be more encompassing and more sort of inquisitive of the sources of stress in terms of social suffering, in terms of the suffering that's caused by institutions in society. I know I'm going on and on, but just as an example, in the business and corporate world, I remember seeing a figure last year in the Wall Street Journal that corporations are losing $300 billion a year due to stress-related illnesses and stress-related problems. So the fix is, okay, let's provide these people a corporate mindfulness training program so they can reduce their stress and get back to work. That's good. I mean, I think that's great. But I think where we're falling short on this is asking the deeper question is, why is there so much stress generated in modern corporations and in the workplace? And so these are the sort of the larger issues that I'm interested in.
Yeah, yeah. And I must say your articles are more critical than your expressing yourself now. There was some really, I pulled out some quotes and I thought there were some really hard hitting remarks in there.
That's the S. I mean, when you have to be provocative in terms of
yes,
making your points in a persuasive essay. So
yeah. And you did that really effectively. So you, in your article, you, you know, as you just now, you've mentioned that there's a missing sort of political, social analysis critique about the psychological stresses that we experience. And coming from someone who's teaching in a management program, I wonder if this gets you into trouble.
Well, no, not really. I have academic freedom. No, I'm not really a typical management professor, and I may be a bit of a misfit.
Yeah. You're definitely not giving the party line in terms of being somewhat, you know, somewhat critical of the direction of where business is going. I've been involved in market research for these 25 or 30 years now, and so have some alliance with the whole world of business as a result of that. Something I never thought I would do, and. One of the things that I've been aware of is that while my field of market research and the professional organization that I belong to, they put a lot of emphasis on ethics, but it's more like the ethics of how we treat respondents and so on, and how we treat confidentiality and those sort of mechanical concerns, if you will, but never a questioning of sort of a larger sense of ethics of where is all of this going, and what's our role in that? But that's a bit of a digression here. So and part of your critique also has been the lack of relationship to Buddhism, and you say there's a non-religious secular path into meditation, and you see pros and cons in relation to that. So. Say a little bit more about what's being lost in the secularization of mindfulness, in letting go of the Buddhist ties. In fact, and you've kind of already foreshadowed this a bit in the article. You suggest that mindfulness has been given the imprimatur of science and is in effect being rebranded to be more palatable to the general public, suggesting that mindfulness is Buddhist meditation without the Buddhism.
Right.
Yeah. Well, so what's lost if we, I mean, in a way, I can kind of relate to that idea. Oh, yeah, it's you get the good stuff without the rigmarole.
Right. Some people say without all the mumbo-jumbo.
Yeah.
Cultural baggage. There's lots of the ways of describing that.
Yeah.
This is a very complicated question and subject, but I think one of the issues here has to do with a claim. And one of the major claims that is made is that a particular form of mindfulness is a way of extracting the essence of a 2,600-year-old tradition. and extracting the juice out of that tradition, and then saying that this is the whole essence of a tradition in this one practice. And not only that, but it's universal. That's the claim, is the idea that, there's a universal essence which can be extracted, and which makes another kind of like sub-claim that it's almost a non-cultural, sanitized version of mindfulness that's immune to cultural influences. But it's quite an irony in a way, because, you know, the intention, I think, is good behind that, to make it available to a wide audience that may not want to have anything to do with any sort of religious trappings or affiliation. The intention is good. However, by trying to extract an essence and claim that now we have the pure universal Dharma embedded in a secular practice makes it actually quite open to all the Western cultural influences that then could come in and appropriate that for various purposes. And so in a way, it started out in hospital settings. It started out in, you know, very controlled environments where there was kind of an implicit Hippocratic oath to do no harm and that sort of thing. But it's gone beyond that. It's now in corporations. It's now in the military, government, schools. And so I don't know how to actually respond to the question about what is lost. I think it's more of what is ignored, in the sense that it becomes almost like a technology or a instrumental tool that can be applied in any context for virtually any purpose.
Yeah.
And to me, that is troublesome. And a lot of people would say, well, you know, it's helping people, so what's the problem? And I'm saying, well, that's not a problem. I don't have any problem with it helping people. But we have to look at the larger context in terms of, as you were saying, that, you know, if we're making people more comfortable and more adapted to a maladaptive institution, are there, you know, broader questions about whether we should even be calling this mindfulness? Because I think that mindfulness inherently has a ethical component, at least where it came from. So what might be lost is basically an awareness and a concern for teaching mindfulness, presenting it in such a way that it retains its ethical efficacy. And, you know, you could think of mindfulness. There's a very nice article that just came out by a Buddhist monk, a British Theravada Buddhist monk by the name of Ajahn Amaru. He makes a very interesting point, because he's saying, well, mindfulness is not a monolithic entity. It has various levels and dimensions to it. And a very stripped down version of it is kind of like the basic level. And mindfulness in originally the Pali term for mindfulness is sati, which has many meanings, but at a very basic level, it does mean, you know, the act of paying attention. But that's very neutral. That's a neutral sort of quality, the act of paying attention.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can enhance your ability to pay attention very, very deeply by practicing this kind of base level, what Ajahn Amaru calls mechanistic mindfulness. And, you know, the classic example that's often used is the sniper. Now, a sniper is very popular now in our American imagination culture, but it's true that, you know, snipers have a profound sense of ability to pay attention non-judgmentally to the present moment. And so I think that what's lost is you know, going further into the potential of how this practice can incorporate the full awareness, you could say, of the ethical side of mindfulness.
Yeah.
And the wisdom of aspects, which we haven't even gotten to.
You know, just in passing, I noticed as you were talking that the same criticism has been, or a similar criticism has been leveled against the very practice of psychotherapy, you know, that psychotherapy is helping people to adjust to a sick system. So there's a similarity there.
Oh, there is. And in fact, you know, I've I'm very interested in that literature now. There's actually some new work coming out. There's a book coming out called The Happiness Industry, and there's another book coming out called The Wellness Syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's that strand of critical psychiatry. And yeah, I quote in some other article, perhaps, Eric Fromm's work, which really, I think, speaks to what you're saying. And he had this term called the pathology of normalcy.
Uh-huh.
And he was very critical of the psychiatry of his day, because he saw psychiatry and psychoanalysis as doing exactly what you're saying. It was a way of just kind of putting the burden on the individual for all their anxieties and psychological problems. And he's saying, yeah, are we just basically helping people accept the status quo of a very pathological culture and society? So I think there is a real similarity there.
Yeah.
That I'm thinking a lot about right now.
I flagged a bunch of your quotes that I think are just too good to not throw into the discussion here, even though you've already made these points.
All right.
but we can make them so much better sometimes when we're writing, right? Because we can think about it
and
wrap just the right words around it. And,
right.
I know I write much better than I speak.
Oh, well, me too.
Or at least I used to. And so here's one quote you write. These are all familiar tropes of the mindfulness movement, that science, in validating mindfulness practice, has liberated it from the flaky, foreign, irrational, outdated, and spooky metaphysics of religious tradition. So that was one that I thought was particularly hard-hitting, and it's a point that you've already made here. And then I have another, a longer paragraph that I'd like to read, and you write, to say that one has arrived at a universal essence of an ancient world religion is not only a bold claim, but it bears the stamp of colonialism with its rhetoric of universal reason. Mindfulness is now being marketed as a scientifically tested natural food for the mind. I love that phrase. Purged of all the extraneous fat and toxic preservatives of Asian cultural baggage. If this sounds familiar, educated Westerners and Western entrepreneurs appropriating elements of Asian culture with the attitude that modern modes of thought provide a privileged understanding and means of employing of those otherwise exotic elements, it should. It is characteristic of the imperialist mindset, which says, we know better than you what you are about.
Yeah.
Do you care to comment on that?
Well, yeah, maybe. I think that Buddhism historically actually kind of did the same thing. I mean, in a way, a lot of people don't realize that there have been, even within the Buddhist tradition, what's called single practice traditions that made a lot of promises to the lay people. Not that they actually meditated. I mean, most people in the Asian world, lay people, and even many of the monks, never really meditated. Really, it was a very exclusive endeavor for a limited number of monastics. But there had to be a relationship between the monastics and the lay people, and basically, Buddhism had to sell itself to keep itself alive. So it made many appeals to the laity in terms of offering a wide range of practical benefits. And so, you know, this practical benefits approach is nothing new. I mean, because if you go back in history, you know, many Buddhist teachers would offer supernatural support to the kings and emperors, or do some chants, or provide, you know, amulets or lucky charms or whatever it may be to ensure, you know, prosperity, or to deal with droughts and floods, you know. So in a way, the Buddhists aren't all innocent about this as well. So in a way, this idea of purging and rejecting these Asian trappings this is a way to, you know, actually, you know, offer these practical benefits to the concerns of the Western consumer. So it's there's a lot of similarities in terms of, because now with the mainstreaming of it, it appeals to middle-class concerns, you know, our self-image, our health, our relationships, our work, mindfulness for children, mindful eating. And so I don't want to let Buddhism off the hook either on that.
Interesting perspective. I appreciate your throwing in that historical perspective. A little bit more on something that you commented on earlier, which was to say that some of the scientists that you're in touch with also are concerned about the overhyping of mindfulness. And you quote Catherine Kerr, who directs the neuroscience lab at Brown's Contemplative Studies Initiative, as being concerned that hyping of mindfulness research is doing a disservice. And the quote is, if this wave of hype continues, she warns in a blog post for Tricycle magazine, there could be negative consequences and the backlash will be too strong. And she worries that people will lose faith and revert to the other side. Mindfulness has no value. And so that's exactly what I was reaching for when I suggested that we seem to be in a mindfulness bubble. And let's see, what other quotes do I have here? You write, the Buddha certainly did converse with leaders and the merchant class, but what he taught them was not a mindfulness-based intervention so they could simply feel better about themselves, nor did the Buddha simply provide them a meditative technique for improving concentration so that kings and merchants could obtain wealth and riches for their own sake. Rather, the Buddha advocated a wiser form of ethical leadership based on fair and just means for the acquisition and proper use of wealth.
Yeah. But let me comment on the first aspect of the hyping of science. Yeah, Kathy Kerr and Willoughby Britton are both at Brown. They're in the Contemplative Studies program there. And they've been really, I think, quite vocal about this. It's interesting that I think what we're experiencing is that the public enthusiasm has outpaced the actual evidence. And part of that is just the way the media operates and the way they take certain studies and then overstate the actual results and implications. And even scientists to some degree. In the early stages of getting grant funding, you have to kind of have enthusiasm for the work, draw attention to the work. But there are issues there. I think that Willoughby Britton actually has another article in Tricycle that speaks to this very, very clearly, is that she warns of basically experimenter allegiance, for example, is an issue where if you're the creator of the therapy or the method and you're doing the research, you know, how biased are you? If you're an advocate for the particular method, even if you're, I mean, a lot of these scientists are meditators themselves or even Buddhists. And so, you know, the question then becomes, you know, to what degree are you an advocate for the science versus are you dispassionate about the results? And then I think what we run into a lot in terms, and this is not just limited to mindfulness by any means, is the positive publication bias, where only positive results seem to be making it into the journals, because journals don't have a bias against reporting negative and null hypotheses and confirmations. So there's that. And I think Kathy Kerr is one of the good spokespersons out there to kind of raise these issues.
Yeah. Let's get into your mindfulness article in the Huffington Post, in which you really went into the ethical dimension that you've already spoken about, and you take up the ethical dimension, especially in the context of business. For example, you write, the booming popularity of the mindfulness movement has also turned it into a lucrative cottage industry. Business-savvy consultants pushing mindfulness training promise that it will improve work efficiency, reduce absenteeism, and enhance the soft skills that are crucial to career success. Some even assert that mindfulness training can act as a disruptive technology. That's a one of those currently popular catchphrases. Everybody wants to have a disruptive technology. Reforming even the most dysfunctional companies into kinder, more compassionate, and sustainable organizations. So far, however, you write, no empirical studies have been published that support these claims.
Right. Yeah. I actually presented at the Mind and Life Institute conference in November and did another literature review to see if any studies had come out in the top-tier journals. in the field of management and organization, and there were none. So again, I think that this is another example of the overselling, overstating the claims. And the corporate world is a very interesting case study, I think, in terms of what's going on with mindfulness. I don't think we just don't have the information of what's actually being done in these firms. We have a lot of anecdotal stories. We have a lot of case studies, but that's not systematic empirical research. And you know, one of the issues here that I think is treated very well by a person by the name of Joel Best, he wrote a book called Flavor of the Month, Why Smart People Fall for Fads. And he makes a very interesting point in this book that he's not talking about hula hoops and things like this. He's really talking about institutional fads. And institutional fads, when you're in the midst of, you could say, a trend, it's hard to know whether it's a fad or not. It's very difficult.
Is there an example that comes to mind, a past example that we might recognize?
Yeah, well, at one time in the corporate world, quality circles were a very, very trendy initiative.
Oh, yes, I remember that.
We thought, okay, they worked in Japan, and so if we bring them over here, and every factory, every American corporation starts implementing quality circles, all the productivity problems will be solved. And that didn't last very long. I think it was 5 to 7 years. But I think the point that he makes is what he calls the illusion of diffusion. And basically, again, it goes back to the point that enthusiasm is outpacing the evidence. And when enthusiasm gets ahead of the evidence, then we might be heading towards a very non-sustainable movement or initiative.
Yeah, this put me in mind of the positive psychology movement, which I'm sure you're in touch with as well.
Yeah.
Because you mentioned the happiness stuff and all. And even Martin Seligman, I think, in some interview, remarked that the enthusiasm and the press had gotten much further ahead of, you know, of the science. And as much as he had, in fact, I think, been a marketer of this, it seemed like he was expressing some alarm that had kind of gotten away from him.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, it's the popularization, I think, of mindfulness. And when it's sold as it's good for everything, I think, then, you know, that should be really a red flag. I'm very critical, actually, I'll say right now, of Arianna Huffington. She has a book out called Thrive. And basically, she came up with this idea of the third metric of success. And the first two metrics are money, and the second is power. And the third metric is well-being, and under well-being is included, mindfulness is included in that rubric there. So what I find interesting is that she doesn't seem to have any sort of problem with maybe seeing that this third metric, which also has the word wisdom in it in her framework, maybe, you know, this might actually conflict and run counter to these primary metrics of money and power, but it's basically sold that you can have your cake and eat it too. You really don't have to change your morals. You don't have to change your ethics. It's a very uncritical stance, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. I hear some. I hope you don't mind. I keep throwing your words back at you here from your article. But I was just so impressed by it. And this quote, I think, relates to this ethical dimension that we're talking about right now. You write, mindfulness as understood and practiced within the Buddhist tradition is not merely an ethically neutral technique for reducing stress and improving concentration. Rather, mindfulness is a distinct quality of attention that is dependent upon and influenced by many other factors, the nature of your thoughts, speech, and actions, our way of making a living, and our efforts to avoid unwholesome and unskillful behaviors while developing those that are conducive to wise action, social harmony, and compassion. And I was particularly interested in your point that Buddhists distinguish between right mindfulness and wrong mindfulness. What can you tell us about that distinction?
Right. Certain schools and certain traditions make that distinction. I think we're probably talking about the Theravada tradition, especially here, that where that comes from. But in one particular tradition of the Theravada school, as I was saying earlier, that mindfulness is at the base level can be a neutral function, but the purpose of the Buddhist path is an integrated path of ethical and moral development, and that's called the Eightfold Path. And so you have all these other path factors, like you were mentioning, right speech, right intention, right livelihood, that are, and actually right mindfulness is the seventh factor of the Eightfold Path. So these are an integrated systemic framework which works synergistically with each other. So, you know, for example, if you are constantly deceiving and lying and you try to sit down to meditate, your mind's not going to be very calm. It's not going to be very conducive to entering into a meditative state because you're already troubled. You're already absorbed in sort of anxieties, maybe guilt. And so I think that what comes to mind here is that when we lose sight of the ethical side of mindfulness, then we run into situations where, for example, you see mindfulness now being offered to hedge fund managers on Wall Street at Goldman Sachs. And they talk about mindfulness not in terms of how it asks questions of what whether their trades are affecting people in a malicious way or a negative way. No, they're actually referring to their experience of how it ups their game, how it increases their ability to go in and make a killing like a ninja warrior.
Uh-huh.
So, and this is not historically new, because we actually saw co-optation of Zen in Japan during World War II. There's a great book by Brian Victoria called Zen at War, where he basically chronicles the co-optation of Zen for military purposes. It was a complete distortion of the Buddhist teachings to actually twist them in such a way that you can become a better warrior and actually be practicing the Dharma. So it's an interesting phenomenon when mindfulness becomes so popular that it may lose its ethical moorings in grounding.
Well, that's interesting. I did not know about that World War II thing that you just referred to, and it certainly makes sense. I mean, we've seen a lot of glorification here of the idea of the ninja warrior and so on. And it's easy to see how that transition could happen. Now, there could be a sort of how it could be ethically bent. I don't know, it raises some very interesting questions here. What would be your sense of, quote, right relationship between secular mindfulness and Buddhist spiritual practice? You know, what's our takeaway here in terms of the to-do, if you will?
Well, I think there's some common ground in that both have the intentions of reducing suffering, but when we use the word suffering, that's a Buddhist term usually. That's translated as dukkha. So there is some common ground. I think that the secular mindfulness, more I would say in the clinical side, has definitely been concerned with helping to alleviate people's chronic pain, stresses, and anxieties. And Buddhism shares a similar concern with reducing suffering, but or dukkha. But it's not just our physical symptoms that Buddhism is concerned with reducing. It's really more the soteriological aims of Buddhism and are religious in nature. And I think that's where the paths diverge, in a sense, that the Buddhist path of liberation is liberation from the wheel of suffering. And here you're starting to get into more traditional ways of thinking about why we suffer and the root causes being the notion that I'm deluded about the true nature of myself, the true nature of my identity. And so to get at that sort of delusional root cause requires a meditative practice supported by a community, which is known as the Sangha. I think the dialogue between secular mindfulness and Buddhism is very rich. And I don't think we should lose sight of the fact that historically, Buddhist schools and traditions have survived as a living tradition because of the intense debates and discussions between themselves. Uh-huh. A lot of arguments and debates within the Buddhist tradition.
Yeah.
It's an intergenerational debate that keeps it going. It's not just a relic from the past. So I think that when it comes to what's going on in the secular mindfulness community, that we should appreciate these differences and these debates. And I think one of the issues in the Truthiness article was that in order to sell mindfulness and in order to brand it as sort of a scientific approach, people like Sam Harris basically are saying things like, well, you know, why need religion at all? And, you know, let's just move on. Or Dan Harris made some remarks that, you know, mindfulness has a huge PR problem, meaning, yeah, Buddhism, let's get rid of that. Then we could, you know, really move forward. I think that's a real sad, not very constructive way to keep the dialogue going between the secular mindfulness community and the Western Buddhist community. And I think another issue here is that science is not the only game in town here. If we start from the premise of science, we're already sort of limiting the dialogue. We're already sort of privileging that dialogue because science has certain criteria what it considers to be valid experience. And it also has a particular way of verifying truth claims based on looking at physical processes. And so there's a kind of a built-in reductionism to a lot of the dialogue, even among scientists who are contemplative scientists. Because a lot of the metaphysical aspects of Buddhism, which can never lend themselves to the scientific method, reincarnation, karma, extraordinary psychic abilities, or the siddhas, those sorts of things would not enter the dialogue if science was the only arbiter of that dialogue. So I think what's starting to happen now is that, and you probably are quite familiar with this, is to bring in the human sciences, which are the humanities, anthropology, philosophy, phenomenology, those sorts of, could say, marginalized disciplines to come into dialogue with Buddhism and as part of this secular mindfulness movement. I think we could really advance the field that way.
Yeah, I definitely agree. We're on the same page, and you've stated that so well. You know,
the takeaway? Okay. Well, not being a psychotherapist myself or a clinician, I don't know if I have anything really authoritative to say, but there is a very strong interest right now among some clinicians and researchers. I already mentioned Willoughby Britton, and she's probably the most prominent one who started to notice that people that were meditating and that people that were practicing mindfulness, and we're talking just, you know, clinical mindfulness, secular mindfulness, experienced some really traumatic things happen to them. And she started becoming concerned that maybe mindfulness is not for everyone, or maybe the way it's taught needs to be carefully examined, because she noticed that some people were having experiences of depersonalization or de-repression, where, you know, highly emotionally charged material or traumas were kind of coming up, or strange energies or insomnia. And so she's actually doing some really great research on this, called, and it's a project that she's working on. It's called The Varieties of Contemplative Experience. So I think there's a lot to be learned there in terms of, and I think psychotherapists actually could play a really important role here for even traditional Buddhist meditators. A lot of prominent teachers like Joseph Goldstein and Jack Kornfield out of the Insight Meditation Vipassana schools, you know, they're coming forward and saying, you know, meditation is not going to cure everything. It's not a, there's still a lot of psychological issues that are, that come up in retreats that people still have to deal with, and simply trying to sweep them under the rug or tell them to meditate more may not be the best advice. So I think that for psychotherapists, getting good training in mindfulness is absolutely essential if they're planning on teaching it to their clients. And I know that there's a lot of debate about that, whether it should be taught strictly as a technique or whether the therapist themselves should be a experienced practitioner. I'm not an expert enough to really comment on those sorts of issues. But
okay, well, those are definitely relevant comments. And as we wrap things up here, in an email you mentioned something about a conference you're working on. What can you tell us about that?
Yes, I'm working on organizing, and I'm co-chairing a conference at San Francisco State University. It's called Mindfulness and Compassion, the Art and Science of Contemplative Practice. And that will be held June 3rd through June 6th on San Francisco State University campus. And we have some really heavy hitter speakers coming, both from the clinical neuroscience community and from the Buddhist contemplative community. So if anybody wishes to take a look at the website, if you don't mind, I can give you the URL.
Yeah, please do.
It's www.mcc2015.org. So it's www.mcc2015.org. And people can register for the conference on the website. We also have, you know, the kickoff event is on June 3rd, and we have the director of the National Center for Complementary and Alternative Medicine, Dr. Josephine Briggs, out of Washington. She's flying in to kick off the event. And Bob Thurman from Columbia, some people may be familiar with his name.
Yep.
He is one of the first Westerners to become a student of the Dalai Lama, and he teaches at Columbia. We have Matthew Ricard out of France. He is formerly was a biophysicist or biochemist, and then turned Tibetan monk. He's been very involved in the scientific research on meditation. So yeah, we have a lot of great people coming, and you know, the whole idea here is to get a dialogue going. We're not just having keynote speakers; we're having panels, invited panelists that will then engage with the speakers. Panelists will be both contemplatives and people from the humanities, scientists, psychologists. So it's going to be a very, very, I think, stimulating conference.
Yeah, that does sound wonderful. That mm-hmm. sounds really good.
We're also offering CEU credits for psychologists and nurses, so that might be helpful too.
Yeah, great. Well, as we wind down, is there anything else you'd like to add by way of summary?
No, I think we've covered a lot of ground.
Okay, well, good. I think we did too. Dr. Ron Purser, thanks for being my guest on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you.
First of all, you may not have noticed that my side of the audio wasn't up to its usual good quality. It sounded a bit like I was in a tunnel. I had made some changes to my computer setup and didn't notice that the microphone I thought I was speaking into wasn't hooked up. So it was picking up my voice from the computer's internal microphone, which is more distant from my mouth and therefore includes a lot more of the room's ambience. As I listened back just now, at first I couldn't figure out why my sound was so echoey, and then I did figure it out, and what you're hearing now is the quality that should have been in the interview as well. Fortunately, it didn't interfere with the interview process, just with my own perfectionism. As a result of speaking with Ron and reading his two articles, I feel so confirmed by my own sense that there would be a backlash to the mindfulness boom, or what Ron has referred to alternately as McMindfulness, or the mainstreaming of mindfulness, or Buddhist meditation without the Buddhism. Clearly, we both continue to value mindfulness practice, but there are some issues that suggest it not be embraced mindlessly, if you will. As you heard, Ron cautions that ripping the practice from its Buddhist context runs the risk of unmooring it from its ethical restraints and from its connection to community. In addition, I'm interested in the research he alluded to that suggests it's not necessarily good for every condition or every psyche. I hope to follow up on that research that he mentioned on the varieties of contemplative experience. If you're at all interested in this topic, I encourage you to read the two articles that I read quotes from during our interview. One appeared in Salon and the other in the Huffington Post blog. You'll find links to both of these in the bottom of the show notes on our site for this interview.
Greetings, Dr. Dave. This is Jennifer Walrod calling you from Missoula, Montana. I'm a practicing psychotherapist in Missoula and also teach at the University of Montana, your old stomping ground, I understand. Today, I wanted to call and thank you for all your efforts and work to bring us Shrink Wrap Radio. The ways that I have benefited personally from your podcast are more than I can count or will count in this short voicemail. But because of that, I made what I plan as the first of many monetary contributions to you in the hopes to support and encourage your work, as it has been so meaningful to me. So just a quick message of thanks to you, Dr. Dave, and many blessings to you and your work.
Jennifer in Missoula, thank you indeed for your support for my work, and I hope others will take a cue from your generosity. And thanks to the generosity of our volunteers, we have two new transcripts on our site. First is number 433, Transactional Analysis, Past, Present, and Future, with Dr. Van Joynes. And this transcript is thanks to Kai Heimpel. And we also have a new transcript of number 434, Science and Pseudoscience in Psychology, with Dr. Scott Lilienfeld, thanks to Mariana Naldi. And thank you for that, Mariana. Our strategic partner, the Jung Platform, has a new course coming up that I think you will be especially interested in. For the first time, West African spiritual teacher Maladoma Somme will be offering a video webinar about his tribe's elements of their cosmology, and those elements are fire, water, earth, mineral, and nature, and are profound catalysts to reclaiming your personal power. This discourse of each element will inspire listeners and provide a unique glimpse into the healing wisdom of indigenous Africa. The African wisdom tradition has deep insights for practical living in the Western world. Maladoma Patrice Somme is from Burkina Faso, West Africa. In his native language, Maladoma means be friends with the stranger. A gifted medicine man of the Dagara tribe, he holds 3 master's degrees and 2 doctorates from the Sorbonne and Brandeis University. He's the author of Water and Spirit. He's a spokesperson and storyteller of the African wisdom tradition. Now, this course consists of 4 video webinars along with audio recordings for you to keep, and the cost is only $99, but then you can subtract 15% off of that during checkout when you use the code Dr. Dave. That's DRDAVE. Now, the first session is on March 5th, and for full schedule and details and sign up, go to the promos tab on our site and then down to Partners on the pull-down menu there, or you can just go to www.jungplatform.com, and you can find the information on that site. I can also tell you that I will be interviewing Maladoma Somme here at some point. And just to whet your appetite, I'm currently listening to his book of Water and Spirit, Ritual Magic and Initiation in the Life of an African Shaman on audible.com. And if you're not already a subscriber to audible.com, it can be yours for free to keep with no obligation to continue your subscription. It can be yours just by going to audibletrial.com/shrink.
This is Gloria Ullman from Adelaide in South Australia, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave, along with thousands of other listeners who have all been shrink-wrapped to fit on it.
Thank you, Gloria Ullman, longtime supporter. And yes, we've always got room for more on the couch. Your little snippet gave me a nice chuckle, by the way. Now let's take a quick dip into the old email bag. Once again, I'll read just one, and this one is from Selena, who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. Attached is a copy of my transcription of show number 436, Brain, Mind, and Body in the Healing of Trauma by Bessel van der Kolk. If there are any changes or revisions needed to this version, please let me know.
Well, there weren't any changes or revisions needed. She did a beautiful job. And she goes on to say, I really enjoyed this process. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to transcribe for Shrink Wrap Radio. As other transcribers have mentioned, it really does help deepen the experience of understanding the material being shared. It's interesting how our brains fill in material for what we either don't hear or erroneously think we hear when we listen just once and casually. Thank you for all that you do in producing Shrink Wrap Radio for your listeners. Dr. Dave, it's a magnificent resource. Take care. And that's from Selena. Selena, thanks so much for doing that transcription. I wanted to share this email because you so beautifully underscore what I've said here before, that people who volunteer to do transcripts find they get more out of the interview. So thanks, Selena Mitchell, acupuncturist, for not only the transcript, but also helping to make that point. And with that, we better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. Remember that in addition to emails, you can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. And you can leave voicemail on our phone at 415-830-4014. Thanks to Dr. Ron Purser for sharing his own reflections on the secular mindfulness boom. All my Jungian fans will be especially interested in my next interview. It will be with French Jungian analyst Imelda Gaudissart, who has written the definitive book on the life of Emma Jung. That's Carl Jung's wife, for anyone who doesn't know. Personally, I'm really looking forward to it. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.